You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Hello, my name is Chris Coyne, and I serve as the Associate Director of the F.A. Hayek Program, and I am also a Professor of Economics here at George Mason University. I am happy to be joined today by my friend, Ed Stringham. Ed is the Shelby Cullum Davis Professor of American Business and Economic Enterprise and serves as the Director of the Shelby Cullum Davis Endowment at Trinity College in Connecticut. Ed, welcome and thank you for being here today.
Chris, thank you so much for having me.
All right. We are talking about your contribution to the recently published volume, The Legacy of Robert Higgs. And your chapter is co-authored with Spencer Brown, and Spencer was a former student of yours at Trinity. Now he's graduated, so kudos to you for your teaching and working closely with students to write academic papers. That's a wonderful opportunity for your students. But your chapter is titled, Two Paths Toward Anarcho-Pacifism, Lessons from Christianity and Modern Economics. And so I wanted to begin by asking you to speak a little bit about how Bob Higgs's work motivated the core thesis and argument in your chapter.
All right. So Higgs focuses a lot on the growth of government, specifically through the expansion of the warfare state and creating crises to increase power, to whip the public into a frenzy to otherwise accept more restrictions on not only our individual liberty, but to accept expansion of various government programs, including war powers that often end up being adopted in near perpetuity. And so he uses an economic lens to show that what we would call the military-industrial complex can be explained based on the self-interest of the people in charge. So to question the traditional view that the government is there to be protecting us and expanding military to make us safe, in reality, they take many steps to enrich themselves and or the companies that are working closely with them. And so Spencer Brown and I, who's my former student, he is my former student, Spencer Brown did a great job on this paper. And we start by looking at the economic analysis of why government might be engaging in fear-mongering and warmongering towards the detriment of the public.
Yeah, that's a wonderful context to lead us into the rest of our discussion. And before we move into the crux of your argument, I want to focus on two words in your title, two words that you talk about in the paper, and I want to talk about them. Those two words are one, anarchist, second, pacifism, because for many people, these words are quite jarring. They have some kind of connotation. Anarchist or anarchy is chaos. Pacifism is some kind of naive commitment to, you know, not putting up resistance in the face of threats. I realize each of those terms is nuanced, has a very long intellectual history. But if you can just say a few words about each, I'd appreciate it, because both for your chapter, but also intellectually, you've done a lot of work to explore and develop these concepts, which are quite important for thinking about individual freedom, but peaceful social cooperation as well. So say a few words about what you and Spencer are getting at by employing those concepts.
So each of the words has multiple meanings. So in that sense, they're very imperfect words and confusing words because they have their literal dictionary linguistic definition. And then there's oftentimes the bunch of criticisms that people who have other views bake into the definition. And so we're using them quite literally in their linguistic sense. So anarch just means without an overarching authority. That's one of the dictionary definitions. And the other dictionary definition is chaos. And we're not using it in that sense. I do not like chaos. Chaos bad. It's very, very bad. So in general, I might not even use that word because it's very confusing to people. But the idea is that the first definition says that we can organize society without violence and without chaos in a way that is orderly, it's peaceful, and we don't need this overarching authority to be in control of our lives. So there's plenty of interaction everywhere around the world at any moment where the police are far, far away and things work out, you know, quite fine. There was a podcast I just was listening to with Elon Musk where he said some three Twitter employees were literally getting chased by a guy with an axe and they called the police and they said, oh, no, we don't have time to get to that. So that's an example of the chaos. But in many cases, we're interacting quite fine, peacefully, and we do not have the police on every corner, and we figure out how to get things done. And so that's one of the parts of the article. The word passive, pacifistic, pacifism, just means peace, peacemaking, and it means we don't like the Atlantic Ocean, because that's very wavy, just kidding. But peacemaking can be interpreted in many ways. By its critics, it's, oh, you're against whatever necessary military intervention we are supporting. So World War I, especially the United States government was, during Woodrow Wilson and other people, were very much against the pacifists for not being in favor of getting America in World War I. A lot of people were what would be called in modern terminology, isolationists. We just want to do our own thing, trade with all, entanglements with none, to use George Washington's phraseology. And so the critics of this portrayed it in a negative way. So that's one of the not definitions, but connotations of the word. But here again, we're using it quite literally to say, I do support, but just the way we use it in this article is just people support peace and peacemaking. And there's also different within that definition of pacifism. There's varying degrees. So one definition of pacifism is being opposed to government war. That is a fairly broad definition, which I think pretty much, as far as I know, maybe all or most all pacifists support. And then within there are some pacifists who say that at an individual level, maybe, you know, something bad is happening, you can use, you know, force in self-defense. Other pacifists, including Tolstoy, as far as I read him, would say, no, even if somebody's committing a violent crime, you should not be using force against that person. So there are different degrees of pacifism as well.
Yeah, so we have, just to kind of tie this together and then transition, I'm glad you brought up Tolstoy because we'll turn to him in a moment. The anarcho aspect is, as you put it quite nicely, order, not chaos, order without top-down control. The pacifism part is peacemaking. So we're talking order and peacemaking, relying on ordinary people without top-down vertical coercion from above. And then what you and Spencer do is say, okay, given that context, let's think about two pathways through which we might envision, frame, analyze, understand how we might arrive at peaceful order. And one of them is grounded in Christianity. And for that pathway, you leverage Leo Tolstoy, who you just brought up. So say a little bit about Tolstoy, a little bit how it relates to your argument, and then we'll turn to the second pathway, the economics pathway.
So I first tried to read Tolstoy's War and Peace 20 years ago when you and I were in graduate school. And it was a very interesting, but a very challenging book to me at the time. So I wasn't able to fully get through it and appreciate it. But I did end up finishing it completely from about 10 years ago. And I was kind of struck by it and confused by it and thought, okay, this is a novel, but wait, this is more of almost a social commentary. And in one of the introductions, he says, this book is not a novel. So I think that's really interesting. And then from there, I started reading some of his other things, including his book, The Kingdom of God is Within You, which came out, I'm not sure when, but let's just say 1889. And that he explains his personal moral views and his religious views. And he has a long analysis of different Christian perspectives on war and the use of force. And I assigned that in one of my classes where Spencer Brown was taking. So that's how we kind of started getting into this. And he talks about basically his view and other people's view that Christ's Sermon on the Mount is about loving one's neighbor, turning one's cheek, and that's the main message of Christianity, that we need to be treating people with respect and not wanting to be a warmongering, using force, I guess we could just say it more broadly. Now, he did not study economics, and actually, I should say he did study a little bit of economics. He did read Henry George, but I would say he's not a modern economist, and so he's not in favor of big financial institutions in the way that I am or you would be. But nevertheless, he comes to a position which turns out to be somewhat close to, I'll get to that in a minute, the view of modern free market individualist economists, in that the government exists not to actually make things better, but they exist to advance their own interests. They exist to expand power, in many cases, create conflict where it otherwise would not exist. And so for me to be reading this as an economist who has been interested in these ideas for 25 years, to see, wow, this great novelist, maybe we could call him a social philosopher or maybe a moral philosopher, theological commentator, is coming to very similar conclusions from a very different initial starting point. And so Spencer Brown and I found that really kind of fascinating, that two people can come, or two groups of people can come to very similar conclusions and a very parallel sets of analysis from different backgrounds.
Yeah, and then that kind of sets the stage for the next question I have, which is, let's spend a little bit of time talking about the second path. And you touched upon this slightly when I asked the first question about how Bob Higgs motivated or inspired the work in your chapter. But I was hoping you might say a little bit more about the nature of economic or the economic arguments that parallel the Tolstoy / Christianity type arguments that you were just talking about. What are some differences, perhaps, if there are any that you would highlight between them. But as you say, they ultimately lead towards the same endpoint. And so I'm trying to tease out a little bit what the parallels and differences might look like on of these two paths.
Sure. If I may just read a couple sentences from the chapter, we say, Tolstoy says the state is not created to advance morality and instead corrupts it. State actively works to unsettle the public so it can exercise more control. The public must wise up and passively resist violence in the state. And then we say, Higgs concluded basically the same thing. So there are slight differences in what I'm about to read, but not too different. The state is not created to advance economic well-being and instead corrupts it. The state actively works to create crisis so it can expand power. The public must wise up and passively resist violence and the state. So I highly encourage everybody to buy this great edited volume by the best pacifist economist, Chris Coyne. I certainly love your work. It's just fantastic. And your work is a part of a very cool tradition where many people have been talking about this, not just the war is the health of the state style arguments, but that economics is about peaceful interaction. Bastiat talks about that. Richard Cobden talks about that. Mises, people come together and find mutual interests. And through trade, they turn what otherwise could have been a non-relationship into a mutually beneficial economic relationship. So markets bring people close together, and government intervention, on the flip side, interferes with that. And so the more that the government interferes with peaceful interaction between countries, between individuals, the more crisis that it creates between countries, and I should also add within a country.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Thank you for putting that so concisely, because one of the things I really appreciate about your chapters is you draw these parallels, but you also open kind of a new window or perspective for people, hopefully, to see how you can draw upon these different perspectives, economics, religious, ethical, philosophical, and how they all fit together in the broader project of understanding order and peacemaking. And when you think about it in those terms, and this is why I started by asking you about to talk a little bit about anarchism, pacifism, which again, most people kind of find off-putting, but really if they read your chapter carefully, it leads the reader to realize this is not controversial at all for most people. Most people would say they like peace and they like orderly relationships between human beings who are respected as equals. And that's what you push readers to think about. And I want to conclude, because we're coming to the end of our time, by asking you to share your thoughts with us about the ongoing legacy of Robert Higgs, because part of the purpose of the volume was to talk about the legacy he has created, but also to be forward-looking. And, you know, one of the opportunities or points I want to highlight is your own work on this as a potential inroads for future and subsequent work, and specifically your book, Private Governance. And we always call it Private Governance, that's the main title, but the subtitle of your book, which we rarely say, but I'm going to say it now because it's important, Creating Order in Economic and Social Life. Creating order. Order's not there, it's not imposed, it's created by the interactions of human beings who are operating in not just narrowly economic life, but social life as well. And so leave us with a few thoughts about where you see the legacy of Robert Higgs. You can couch it in terms of your own work, the work of others, but how would you respond to that about the vibrancy of his research program for understanding the world going forward?
I think that he has a lot of important contributions on how government destabilizes existing order. And so that means that order precedes government. And he does mention later on in his career that he came to adopt what we could call the anarcho position. And so certainly I would thank you for mentioning my work, Private Governance, my favorite book of all time. But also, you know, your work with Abby Hall is just, I think, a great set of applications of these ideas to say, here's some areas where government destabilizes. And I love your current one on the how government, how to create wars. I forget the title, but it's just so hilarious and not done to be serious, but a very serious work about a very serious topic. So I think that from a societal perspective, people do agree with this. I was living in San Jose and San Francisco 15 years ago, and I was surprised that there was a headline of the San Francisco Chronicle that said, oh, government's expanding these wars to expand their power. I'm like, wow, that is really interesting. So I think that there are at least a lot of people now in America who don't like these forever wars, and they've wised up and say it was a mistake to get into all these forever wars over the last 20 years in the Middle East. So that's good. And then to relate this to Tolstoy, we've been talking about him specifically, but two of the most influential people in the past century explicitly say that they were influenced by Tolstoy's Kingdom of God is Within You, specifically Gandhi and Martin Luther King. So this book that he wrote is not as widely talked about as War and Peace, but if you look at who it influenced, the people who helped bring about change in a peaceful way, I think that modern observers and people who want to bring about social change can do so in a much more peaceful and productive way by reading the works of Robert Higgs and Leo Tolstoy and Abby Hall and Chris Coyne.
Well, thank you, Ed. And the title of the volume is The Legacy of Robert Higgs. For listeners who are interested in reading in more detail what Ed and I talked about today, please pick up the volume and check out Ed's chapter co-author with Spencer Brown. And all of the references to the various books and articles that Ed and I mentioned are cited in that volume. And Ed, I want to thank you again both for contributing to the book and for joining me today. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Hello, my name is Chris Coyne, and I am the Associate Director of the F.A. Hayek Program and a Professor of Economics at George Mason University. Today, I am joined by my colleague, Dom Boudreau, who is a professor of economics at George Mason and a senior fellow with the F.A. Hayek program. Don, thanks for speaking with me.
It is my pleasure, Chris.
Today, we are discussing your contribution to the recently published volume, The Legacy of Robert Higgs, and your chapter is titled Regime Uncertainty and Market Uncertainty. And I want to begin by asking you to talk a little bit about what regime uncertainty is, and especially in the context of the Great Depression. I want to read a line here from the opening passages of your chapter to put this in context. You write, "To my mind, the first and so far only plausible explanation of the Great Depression's length didn't come along until 60 years after the fact. That explanation is supplied by Robert Higgs's concept of regime uncertainty." And so talk a little bit about what regime uncertainty is and how it offers insight into helping us understand why the Great Depression was so great in terms of its length.
Regime uncertainty was identified by Bob Higgs as the explanation for the length of the Great Depression. You know, he in earlier work, made a plausible argument that the Depression didn't end until the mid-1940s, until after World War II. And so this is a very long depression. It begins in 1930 and lasts for more than 15 years. So what accounts for this? Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz have a widely accepted account of the start of the Depression, the Fed's failure to stop the money supply from falling by 30%. I mean, the Austrians have a different account for for why we might have had a bust in the early 1930s. But neither of those accounts, and no other account that I'm aware of, succeeds in explaining the duration of the Great Depression. The Keynesians, I suppose, have one, but even that falls, I think, in face of the evidence that we had deficit spending throughout the 1930s. It did nothing to alleviate, certainly didn't cure the Great Depression. The New Deal didn't do it. Bob, I think the term is unique to him, regime uncertainty. He says, look, in the 1930s, there was a growing hostility toward private property, the price system, markets, free trade, and the latter is a little bit ambiguous, but certainly private property, price system. And that attitude, says Bob, caused investors to stay on the sideline. If you believe that your investments are going to be confiscated by the state, if you believe that the fruits of those investments are going to be confiscated, even if the underlying base isn't confiscated, if you're unsure about the legal regime going forward, the regulatory regime, the regime that the courts will enforce going forward, then you stay in the sideline. Why invest? Why put your hard-earned money at risk when government is behaving so with such uncertainty that you don't know if you'll actually maintain ownership of your investments or gain the fruits of those investments? So regime uncertainty is the uncertainty created by government policy and rhetoric, also supported by the public discussion, public support for socialism, and public sympathies for intervention, that cause investors and entrepreneurs to become so skeptical of the security of private property rights going forward that they just stay on the sidelines. If investors are staying on the sidelines, of course, you don't have enterprises being built. You don't have enterprises being maintained and sustained through bad times. Only when that uncertainty diminishes will investors return. And Bob makes a good case that uncertainty did indeed diminish following the end of World War II, the death of Franklin Roosevelt, and the rise to power of Truman, and the surprise take of the U.S. Congress by the Republicans in the 1946 elections.
So after discussing what regime uncertainty is, you turn to this concept of uncertainty the way economists view it. And even in your comments that you just presented, there's this essence of entrepreneurship because there's investment taking place. There is a aspect of open-endedness, the future, forecasting the future, which is where this issue of uncertainty comes in. So then that leads to this fascinating discussion, which I very much appreciate about your chapter, about how economists conceptualize uncertainty. And you contrast two views, which I want to ask you to discuss a little bit about. One is the Chicago view, and one is the Austrian view. And so can you spend a little bit of time talking about the sources of uncertainty for those two broad views of economic activity?
I can, but this is in the context, of course, of another complementary distinction, that between market uncertainty and regime uncertainty. And obviously economists have known since before the time of Adam Smith that the future is not perfectly foreseeable. So we live in a world in which there's some uncertainty and risk going forward. The Chicago view of market uncertainty is that, to put it in language familiar to economists, but it's easily enough grasped non-economists, the Chicagoans believe that risk is a real thing, but uncertainty, they basically forget about it in a lot of their formal work. So risk is... risk exists when you know the possible outcomes moving forward. You don't know which one is going to materialize, but you can attach reasonably accurate probability estimates to each of those outcomes. And it's easily shown in economics that if you can do that, that comes pretty close to basically giving you full knowledge of the future, because you just discount it by the probabilities. Uncertainty, as Frank Knight pointed out famously, is very different than risk. Uncertainty is, we don't even know what the possible outcomes are. And we have no hope of attaching probability estimates to things that we don't even know if they will occur. The Chicagoans, and I'm using that term broadly, not all are as guilty of what I'm about to say as are others. But if you're bent on making a general equilibrium model where everything works nicely, then uncertainty, genuine uncertainty, doesn't fit into that model because there are things you don't know, and you can't be in equilibrium with things you don't know. And when things happen that you don't know, if you have an equilibrium, of course, it gets rid of that equilibrium. And so the Chicagoans opt, by and large, in their formal work, not necessarily their policy work, but in their formal work, they opt to keep the equilibrium framework, and that means jettisoning, getting rid of the uncertainty. They have risk, but they don't have uncertainty. And from the market, there's no uncertainty in the market. So entrepreneurs, when they create things, they don't really create things. They're just directing us to which particular outcome that we have a probability distribution for that we're actually going to reach in the future. So the Chicagoans ignore genuine uncertainty in the market. They, however, being Chicagoans, are perfectly fine with genuine uncertainty created by the state. And so the state can intervene with, you know, radical new changes. And the Chicagoans are more than happy to say, now that's genuine uncertainty. And that can really screw up investment plans. And that can really cause investors to stay on the sidelines. And so I was thinking about this. Ever since reading Bob's work on this, starting in the 1990s, I'm thinking about this distinction. And a question occurred to me early on. Well, you know, I get you, Bob. It's of course true that when entrepreneurs invest, if they're worried about the state interfering, they might choose not to invest as much. But there's also uncertainty in the market. And I come from an Austrian background. And the Austrians, of course, unlike the Chicagoans, aren't wedded to an equilibrium framework. And therefore, we don't have to jettison uncertainty. We recognize uncertainty. In fact, we recognize that uncertainty is created by the very market actions that we celebrate. The entrepreneur comes in with a completely new idea, new product, new method of production. No one predicted it. No one could have predicted it. There's absolutely no way it could have been part of an equilibrium model before the thing came along. So we Austrians actually recognize real uncertainty. And so you might think, and Bob, of course, is a fellow traveler of the Austrians. And so you might think that on a naive interpretation that Bob would say, well, okay, the uncertainty created by government policy, say in the 1930s, extended the Great Depression by suppressing investment. But there's also the possibility that in the market, even when government's behaving itself, that there's such uncertainty unleashed by changes in consumer behavior, entrepreneurial innovation, that too might suppress innovation. After all, from the individual investor's point of view, what the individual investor cares about is the probability of getting a return on some investment. The investor as such doesn't care if the absence of return or the unexpectedly low return is due to regulatory policy or due to the fact that someone came along and built a better mousetrap. And so in my paper, I've gotten ahead of your question. In my paper, I deal with this issue. I ask and then answer in the negative. Does market uncertainty, genuine market uncertainty of the kind that the Chicagoans ignore in their formal work, in the kinds that Austrians take account of in their formal work, does genuine uncertainty pose the same kinds of problems to a market economy as does regime uncertainty created by interventions of government?
Yeah, that's a important distinction. I appreciate you beginning by making that distinction between market uncertainty and regime uncertainty, because that's central to your chapter, but also just for understanding the differentiation of these concepts and how uncertainty operates in different settings, which I want to turn to next. I'm going to read another passage because you touched upon this in your prior answer, but I want to ask you to say a bit more about uncertainty in different contexts. So you write, market uncertainty is uncertainty about how private economic actors, consumers, business executive, entrepreneurs, and investors will spend their own money or money voluntarily entrusted to them. In contrast, regime uncertainty is uncertainty either about how government officials will spend other people's money or about how government officials will obstruct other people from spending their own money. So can you say a little bit more about how the different contexts matter for how both that uncertainty manifests, the different types, but also how people deal with it? It's very different responses to those things.
I read my chapter again this morning, Chris, in preparation for this to have it fresh on my mind. And I think is not uncommon with authors. I came away being less than pleased with the clarity of my exposition. And so it can always be improved. I think what I'm getting at, what I meant to get at there is that while there is genuine uncertainty in markets, we don't know what entrepreneurs are going to do tomorrow in free markets when they're free to create. The range of that uncertainty, I think, is narrower than it is when governments intervene. Governments, precisely because they spend other people's money and the particular government actors, they don't suffer much in the way of personal losses in the way that market actors do. I think it is a bit easier to create in one's mind a range over what kind of actions might be coming down the pike in the market in the future. I think it may be a useful distinction. You know, I alluded to it earlier, this distinction from Frank Knight between risk and uncertainty. And it's often spoken about as if it's a toggle switch where we either have risk or we either have uncertainty. It's really a spectrum, I think, or it might be useful to think of it as a spectrum. And the closer we get to the risk side, the easier it is to deal with the unknown future. The further we get away from the risk side, moving toward the uncertainty side, the more difficult it is. I think in the market, although there's genuine uncertainty, it is more like risk. It has more of an element of risk. It allows people, entrepreneurs, to have some closer semblance of what might occur. It's less likely to be utterly surprising compared to the kind of uncertainty that Bob identified as coming down the pike in the 1930s. I'm aware, for those who read the stuff that you and I read, Chris, and I didn't mean to go down this road, but I find myself sounding like Israel Kirzner, you know, who tries to explain why, you know, he admires Ludwig Lachmann and Lachmann's radical uncertainty, but well, it's not quite there. In my paper, anyone who reads my paper knows that I side with some scholars who take issue with Israel Kirzner. I think effectively they do, but I find myself here having probably the same kind of psychological reaction that Israel Kirzner has. Well, yes, it's uncertainty, but not complete uncertainty. So let me just say, if I can, before going on, in reading my piece, I realize, I think I should have made more of what occurred at the end, or near the end of the piece. And that is, in the market, that which is uncertain is manifested in changes in market prices and other market signals. The regime uncertainty that Bob mentions is uncertainty about the security of physical property rights, including the right to sell your labor. The ability of prices to adjust to changes, genuine creative changes about which we are today uncertain, the ability of prices to adjust to those changes enables the market to deal with the changes, incorporate them into the larger market catalaxy without causing massive destruction. When government intervenes, it prevents the physical use, obstructs the physical use of property, And that has effects on market prices, of course. But the fact that in markets, the physical use of property isn't obstructed. And people can change how they invest their resources. They can liquidate certain resources, move them from industry A to industry B, change their spending patterns, find new sources of supply. I think that's a categorical difference. The government cuts off options. The market makes the market uncertainty might result in and does result in some particular investment projects proving to be unprofitable in ways that their owners dislike, but it doesn't prevent, it doesn't obstruct the reallocation of those resources to new and better uses. And so it's something about the physical destruction, not destruction, the physical obstruction of the use of property that is at work here. Well, I'll leave it there and let you ask me more. It's a subtle distinction. I think it's an important distinction, and it's one that has to be dealt with, because someone can say, well, you know, uncertainty is uncertainty, uncertainty, and so why would the government be the only source? Why not markets? I do think it's a good answer. And we're here engaged in this intellectual effort to flesh that answer out.
Yeah, yeah. And that last line, I think, really hits on the importance of this, because it's not like you're saying uncertainty exists over here, but not over there. It's a universal part of life. So then the question is, how are you going to navigate it? And this point you raised, by the way, I think your chapter is quite clear in its writing, but put that aside for a moment. There's the market process and there's the political process. And those processes, both of which are trying to deal with uncertainty, both of them are dealing with scarce resources and decisions in the face of uncertainty, generate dramatically different outcomes because of the institutional environment you've touched upon. Part of the market process, the way Kirzner, all the market process theorists, even with their differences, one of the things they highlight, as you noted, is it is that uncertainty which both on the one hand encourages entrepreneurial alertness, but also allows market participants to navigate a world of uncertainty. The political process is different for the reasons you touched upon. They don't have the guide of market-generated competitive prices and profit and loss. They are embedded in markets, but the contracting process in government is not the same as the contracting process in private markets. They don't face the profit and loss mechanism the way that private entrepreneurs do. But also important, that's in the production of goods and services. But then in the process of producing stuff, governments also introduce uncertainty, a new form of uncertainty into it. That's the obstruction point I take you to be making. And that does not occur in markets. That legally, you cannot prevent another market participant from doing something. And that's the crux of what I take you to be saying about it. It's different both in the choice calculus, facing decision makers about how to use scarce resources in the here and now because of the absence of profit and loss. And it's different in that it introduces a whole nother aspect of uncertainty.
Just yesterday I should have written it down and I didn't, but I think I can remember it short. Just yesterday on his Facebook page, our emeritus Nobel laureate colleague, Vernon Smith, said something along, he said, this is almost a direct quotation, although not perhaps not exactly. He says, markets direct money to where, to support the profitable, and governments direct money to support the unprofitable. And I think that insight is related here. When a mistake is made and uncovered in the market, as of course they always are, as it's a constant process of trial and error and discovery, then those errors themselves become profit opportunities for entrepreneurs to seize. And so you need to get resources away from the bad, from the least valuable options, and move them to where they're going to create most value. Government, of course, because of political incentives, as well as just the ignorance of government officials, they're not spending their own money, they're spending other people's money. Their incentive is to double down on their own errors. Oh, this And I mentioned a little bit about this in the book. This didn't work. It's not my fault. It's not the government's fault. It's some other fault. Just give me some more money, give me some more power, and we'll get it right going forward. And of course, it seldom does. They seldom do get it right going forward. I do want to point out that also in my chapter, I start off explaining why market uncertainty differs from regime uncertainty with just an empirical example to set up, okay, what's the theory behind it? And, you know, when you look at economic history, we see that when market forces were unleashed starting 200 or 300 years ago, then that did not discourage investment. It encouraged investment. And it was a lot of change, enormous amounts of change, lots of entrepreneurial and financial losses along the way, but there was economic growth along the way. I don't think we have any instances in economic history of market uncertainty being so great as to shut markets down. Oh, we're just so scared of what's going to happen, with new entrepreneurs and new consumer tastes. We're just not going to invest. We're going to go back to the farm. That just doesn't happen. When markets are free, people engage with that uncertainty. And that's what I was trying to get at in the more theoretical part of my paper. Why do they engage with that uncertainty? We know it historically. Why do they engage with it when markets are free, but flee from the uncertainty created by governments?
Yeah. So we're at the end of our time. Let me close with one last question. The purpose of the volume, the legacy of Robert Higgs, was to be both backward-looking, to appreciate and recognize Bob's various contributions to economics, to political philosophy, and for our understanding of the world, but also to be forward-looking, to think about and discuss how all of these things he introduced and contributed can help us understand the world going forward. So if someone said to you, which is what I'm asking you now, what do you see as the relevance of regime uncertainty as a concept for understanding the world today, tomorrow, and into the future? How would you respond to that?
I would say in this case, history will repeat itself whenever regime uncertainty is created by government. There's no reason to believe that the experience we had in the 1930s was unique to the 1930s or unique to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And so as the government gains more discretionary power over our lives, particularly discretionary power over investment decisions, the pricing mechanism, as the regulatory regime becomes more uncertain, less easy to predict, more wild, more given to swing, to great swings as we move toward raw majoritarian democracy. Now we have Democrats in office, we're going to have this regulatory regime. Tomorrow we have Republicans with another regulatory regime. Day after next, we'll have Democrats back in office. That kind of uncertainty is enormous. And that kind of uncertainty, I think, it's regime uncertainty. And it can't help but suppress market investment. It's not to say that it completely shuts it down. It didn't completely shut it down in the 1930s, but my gosh, it certainly lowers it to a level that prevents economic growth. So I think the most obvious lesson is, okay, well, if we fall into another depression, don't do what what we did 90 years ago. But it is broader than that. It is keep the regulatory regime defined broadly, not just the regulatory agencies, but courts, legislation, keep those on an even keel, allow investors to have some confidence that they'll be secure in their property rights and in the fruits of those property rights. And that includes, importantly, the right to make pricing decisions about their property and about the outputs that their properties generate.
Don, thank you so much for contributing to the volume and for speaking to me today. The title of the book is The Legacy of Robert Higgs. And for listeners who are interested in learning more about Bob Higgs's career, but also the topics we've discussed today, please check it out. Don, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.